Welcome back, dear students. In this presentation, we're going to take a look at several of common stock characteristics with an emphasis on dividends, because dividends don't lie. So let's get started on slide 61 with a stock spinoff. A stock spinoff. Well, this is a conversion of one of a firm's subsidies to a standalone company by distribution of stock in that new company to existing shareholders. So the company says, you know what, we have a division that could be on its own, could be a publicly traded company all on its own. So they spin it off, and you will get shares in that new company proportionate to how much of the company they believe that division was worth. Sometimes a new company is still majority owned by the company that spun it off, so they'll keep a bunch of shares in their own pockets. For an example is Kraft, that was spun off from Altria, which used to be called Philip Morris, because people said, well, I'm not going to invest in any tobacco company, but, you know, Kraft is a food company, but I can't invest in Kraft because they're owned by a tobacco company. So they divested Kraft, while Kraft then got together with Hershey, I think? No, Heinz, yeah, Heinz, and hasn't worked out so well for them. Altria, Philip Morris, then divested itself of its international tobacco business, which is now called Philip Morris. And here's a real example of how crazy the world has gotten. Philip Morris International is based in the United States, but it's the company that sells cigarettes outside the United States. So it does no retail business in the United States. Figured that one out. The history of spinoffs have been checkered. Some spinoffs have gone on to do better than the companies that spun them off. And the example of this were the Baby Bells that were spun off from AT&T in 1984. Well, one of them got so large that it engulfed the old AT&T and is now called the new AT&T. That was SBC Communications. And another one got so big it became Verizon. Right, they swallowed each other up. And now they're bigger than AT&T. Well, the old AT&T is gone. Some spinoffs have not done so well. One of the examples of this was Coca-Cola Enterprises. Huh? Well, that was spun off from Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola Enterprises was the company that bottled and distributed the Coke, and Coca-Cola made the syrup that becomes the soda. And Lucent Technologies was another example of a disappointment. It was spun off from the old AT&T. It used to be Western Electric and Bell Labs. And Lucent Technologies was a very potent company with tremendous technology, but they screwed up big time in the tech bubble, as we will see later on. Yeah. Okay, so sometimes a spinoff is a great deal, and sometimes it's not a great deal. And you as a shareholder have to decide, do I want to keep the new stock, because they're going to give you stock in the new company, and you'll still have stock in the old company too. Okay, slide 62. A stock split is more common, and this is, you hear, actually it's not as common as it used to be. This is a maneuver in which the company increases the number of shares outstanding by exchanging a specified number of new shares of stock for each outstanding split. And it's typical. What is typical is a 2-for-1 split. So they go 2-for-1. What does that mean? Well, say you had 100 shares. Wow, you now have 200 shares. Yippee! Well, big deal. The stock price went from $20 down to $10. You see, there's no increase in value. It's an accounting maneuver. And there are 3-for-1, 3-for-2, 1-for-5. That's a reverse split. And why did we used to do these? Well, because of the technology of the time. Remember, we wanted to trade in 100 round lots, 100 share round lots, as they were called. Well, if the stock keeps getting more and more expensive, it's going to be harder and harder for people to buy 100 shares. So a company would split their stock so that it just made it easier to trade. But that's all gone now. Because of technology, you can buy one share just as easily as you can buy 100 shares. And let's read at the bottom. There is no increased value from a stock split. If you had one share at $20, you now have two shares at $10. The value is still the same. You see how it works? One share times $20 is 20. Two shares times $10 is 20. It is a psychological increase at best. And Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway fame has consistently refused to split his stock from its inception, from the beginning. And a share price now goes for over $300,000. One share. Right. And we'll discuss Mr. Buffett's company in just a few other slides, too, because the Wall Street was not happy about him doing this. They wanted them to split, and he just refused to do it. So what he did is he issued a whole new class, as we'll see. All right, so make sure you understand the stock split. There's no increase in value other than the psychological increase. And sometimes the company will split their shares as a way to tell the world that, you know, we think things are pretty darn good for us. Qualcomm did this several years ago. Nothing big was happening, and they just split the shares. And I was pretty sure that meant they thought the future was, near-term future for them was pretty good, and it turned out to be true. Yeah, the stock did pretty well after that. 63, treasury stock. What is treasury stock? Well, these are shares of stock that have been sold and subsequently repurchased by the issuing firm. You might have heard of share buybacks and buybacks. Once the company purchases back those shares, they are taken out of circulation. So what it does is it reduces the number of shares outstanding. And you accounting students, you accounting majors will know what happens if you decrease the supply and the demand doesn't change, the price should go up. The logic being that after the buyback, there is less supply of outstanding stock and existing shareholders now have a larger percentage ownership of the corporation. You see, you're decreasing the supply, so theoretically, it doesn't always happen this way, but that's the way it's supposed to happen, the price should go up. During the run-up of the 1990s, share buybacks were often seen as a better alternative to dividend increases. The belief was that investors were more interested in capital gains than dividends, and that buybacks increased the potential for capital gains by reducing the supply of stock. And it's still going on strong now. Companies are still buying back their shares, and that means they're being taken out of circulation and there are fewer shares outstanding. Slide number 64. This is where we come back to Mr. Buffett's company. Companies will issue different classes of stock. Class A, Class B, Class C. I think one time GM had 7 different classes of stock. Sometimes the B shares are for the family for the founders, and they have certain voting rights or their lack thereof voting rights that the A shares don't, or they get paid a much higher dividend than the A shares. Or in the case of Facebook, they created a class B shares that have all the voting rights. So they basically say we don't want the public to be able to have any say in how we run the company. And some people were angry about that. The Class A shares of the Berkshire Hathaway, those were the ones that were selling for over $300,000, right? In 1996, the financial world pressed Mr. Buffett to offer a lower cost version of his stock. And he didn't want to do it, but he finally relented. I forget exactly why. There was some reason they were pushing to do this. Reason why he relented, they were pushing to do it because they wanted to make it easier to trade. And so they created the Class B shares, which he sold originally for $1,160. So he said, I'll show you. Okay, I'll create these Class B shares, but I'll price them a lot higher than you want me to price them at. And in the prospectus, he said he wouldn't buy them. I wouldn't buy them. You want to buy my shares? You buy my A shares. That's it. Well, it became increasingly harder for him to use his A shares when he would take over another company as cash. You can use your shares like cash if you want to take over another company. And so he saw that these B shares, they could be used to buy other companies. So he split them 50 to 1 in 2013, which made them much, you know, it reduced the price, right? Remember, you sleep the 2-for-1, you're going to drop the price in half. If you split 50-to-1, you're going to drop the price by a factor of 50. And they went down. I forget what number, but now they're back up to 230. And he uses these B shares, to be able to buy other companies. So he found that maybe splitting stock is not the worst thing that can happen to you. Slide 65. Now, a few others are par value, which is usually pretty meaningless. I'm not even sure why they do this. They say the par value is a penny or 0.001 pennies or $1 or whatever. It's just a stated value of a stock, which is meaningless. The other two are the book value and the market value. The book value. You accountants would be able to tell us more about this, because that's the amount of the shareholders' equity in a firm. So that equals the amount of the firm's assets minus the firm's liabilities. And it is shown on a per share basis. So you'll often say, well, what assets do they have on the books? Because this is for the accountants to determine how much cash, how much inventory, how much accounts receivable, how much accounts payable. And so if you've taken accounting, don't go screaming into the night. There's no accounting in this class. We just use what the accountants do for us, okay? So the book value is typically far less than the market value. The market value is what the stock is selling for. And of course, that changes by the minute during the open days when the market is open. But that's a better estimate of what the company's worth. But sometimes it's not a very good estimate. Sometimes the market way overvalues companies, and sometimes they way undervalue companies. But it is typical that the market value will be higher than the book value. If it is not, if the company is hit on hard times and the market value falls below the book value, there is a real danger of that company being seized, being taken over by corporate raiders, by takeover artists, by private equity firms. And why do they do this? Well, they see the stock and they say, the stock's selling at $5, but we think the assets in the company are worth $10. So what do? They buy 50% plus one of the shares, which means now they control the company. And they can buy more if they want. They can buy all the shares now that they've controlled 50% plus one of the company. And then they liquidate the company, pay off the liabilities. And if they did their calculations correctly, the assets should be worth more than liabilities. They walk away with money in their pocket. You understand? And does that make people upset? You better believe it does, because you worked for this company for 22 years and now they're put out of business because this corporate takeover artist came in his three-piece suit and his private jet and took the company private and liquidated all the assets and told you to go home because you no longer have a job. That's why we have unemployment insurance, dear students. We don't have unemployment insurance to pay people not to work. We have it because that's exactly what we want. That capital, fancy word for resources, that capital was locked in a company that was failing. And it's time for it to be plowed under and turned into resources to be used for another more productive and profitable adventure. Does that make sense? Yeah, it doesn't help much to give people a lecture on capitalism when they've lost their jobs. So what we do is we give them unemployment insurance because we want them to be working someplace where they are being productive, where it makes more sense, more efficient. It sounds all high-minded and theoretical, and it is, because in real practice, it doesn't always work out very well. Sometimes the private equity artists wind up holding the bag, and the company's going to go bankrupt no matter what happened. So they maybe came in way too late, and now they can't sell anything. But in theory, it makes a lot of sense. And so that's why. Don't let anybody tell you we have unemployment insurance so that we can have people not working. No, we want them to work, but we want them to work someplace where it makes sense. Okay, so enough of that lecture there. Excuse me. Slide 66. Finally, dividends. Remember we said dividends don't lie? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We love dividends. And dividends are shares of earnings given to stockholders. The company can, they are not under any obligation, but the company can pay earnings, and typically they're paid quarterly. And this is true of countries that had something to do with the United Kingdom sometime in their past. Canada, United States, South Africa, Australia, Hong Kong. Yeah, because the English ran Hong Kong for 100 years. So companies that are based in countries that had, and the UK itself, they usually pay quarterly. Whereas companies outside that area, they will pay semi-annually, maybe annually. So remember that, quarterly in the United States. The board of directors meets and they decide how much, if any, dividends should be paid and when to pay them. Again, they could not pay them. The company could be paying dividends for years and then all of a sudden say, no, we're not going to do it. They're under no legal obligation. Although some companies have been paying dividends for decades. The dividends are usually described as a percentage of the earnings per share. And so what's the earnings per share? Well, we're going to take a look at that. That's the amount of annual earnings available to common stockholders as stated on a per share basis. Huh? It means, look, you bought this share of stock for $20. How much did that one share earn? 50 cents, a dollar, whatever. Maybe zero, maybe negative. So let's take a look at the example on slide 67. The company reports a net profit of $1 million. So is that a lot of money? Well, to you and me, it is. But for this company, we don't know until we know how many shares are outstanding. And if there are 500,000 shares outstanding, we take $1 million in earnings divided by the 500,000. Oops, I went too far. We got to click, got to hold and then click. 500,000 shares, and that's equal to $2 earnings per share. You see? They made $2 for every share. Each one of you can think of each one of your shares as a little factory, and it made a little business. It made $2. Now, the board of directors might decide to pay out 50% of the earnings per share in the form of dividends. So the dividend payout ratio would be 50%. 50% of $2 that they earned would be $1. So every shareholder who earned a share would get $1 for every share that they own. That's pretty straightforward. Now, some companies, they need that money. They're growing. They need to reinvest those earnings back into the company. And what is it called, you accounting majors? Retained earnings, right? But other companies, no, we got everything we need. We can afford to distribute that money to the shareholders. Cool. So now let's go to slide 768. Here we are, and take a look at the dividend yield. So this dividend yield is very important, and we'll see why. A measure that relates the dividends to share price and puts the stock dividends on a relative percentage basis rather than an absolute dollar basis. Well, what does that mean? If the stock in the previous slide that was paying a dollar dividend were selling for $20, then you would take a dollar divided by the price, $1 dividend divided by the price of $20, and that would give you a 5% dividend yield. So what does this do? It makes it easier for us to compare our stocks with other income-oriented vehicles such as bonds or savings accounts. Now, what's the difference? The dividends are optional. The company next quarter could just say, nope, we're not going to pay dividends anymore. And the stock price could fall. Whereas the bond, that's required by the bond indenture, the mortgage, basically the documents, the loan documents, to continue to pay you the interest. And the savings account, of course, that's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government up to $250,000. So we're looking at the percentage yield as a way to compare, but realize that they're very different types of investments. Traditionally, 3-6% was normal. In the 1990s, dividends went to 2% or less, and then they came back above 3% in 2008 and 2009, and now we're back to around 2%. So that's what people have come to expect. Now, of course, some companies pay far less. They pay zero dividends. growth-oriented companies, and some companies pay far more income-oriented. Remember value, the term we bandied about back in Chapter 4 when we talked about growth and income stocks, growth and income mutual funds. I'm sorry, growth and income mutual funds. So some companies are not paying very much dividend at all, and other companies are paying very healthy dividends. Slide number 69, with regard to dividends, what are the important dates? Well, there are four important dates here. The date that the board declares the dividend. They say, okay, we're going to pay a dividend, and this is how much the dividend is going to be, and you have to be a shareholder of record on the date of record. So they don't do it the same day. They give you plenty of time to decide whether you want to buy the shares and get the dividend. So that's the date on which an investor must be registered shareholder of a firm to be entitled to receive the dividend. But the ex-dividend date is actually 3 business days before the date of record. What? What are you talking about? Well, it turns out that when you today buy a share of a company or shares of a company, you don't actually get those shares until 3 business days later. Stocks settle in 3 business days. That it used to be 5 business days. You used to have to wait a whole week. But now it's 3 business days. Mutual funds, 1 day. Bonds, 1 day. Savings account, same day. But stocks take 3 days for you to actually receive the shares. So that's why you have to buy them 3 days before. That's why the shares go ex-dividend 3 days before. So if you're so inclined, I mean, if you're just buying the shares to get the dividend, you have to make sure you have bought them before 3 days before. And then the payment date is usually a few weeks after the date of record. That's when you actually get the money in your pocket. They don't send you a check anymore. They electronically deposit it in your brokerage account. And if you want them to send you a check, they'll do it, but they don't want to do that because it costs them, you know, a lot more money than just doing everything electronically. So let's take a look at an example here. Here, why is the ex-dividend date 3 days before the date of record? Because stock transactions close in 3 days. For example, if you purchase a stock on June 15th, you do not actually get the stock until June 18th, assuming there's fin de semana, end of the weekend in a way. All right, say it was a Monday and then 3 days later on Thursday. Theoretically, the opening share price on the ex-dividend date should drop in price commensurate with the amount of the dividend. Theoretically. Why? Because you're taking a dollar away from the company for every share. So if there's a dollar per share dividend, the opening stock price on that ex-dividend date should be reduced by a dollar. It never works that way because prices are changing all the time. And often the dividend might be 25 cents or 10 cents. And so you can't even notice a 10 cent difference because the stock price is bouncing around all over the place. So theoretically, it should be reduced, but in practice, it doesn't usually work that way. So what you're going to hear on slide 71, what you're going to hear in the industry is don't buy the dividend. You don't hear it as much anymore, but used to, don't buy the dividend. And the translation is, look, you're better off waiting until the ex-dividend date before buying the stock. Why? Well, here's the logic. Dividends are taxable transactions. If you buy the dividend, you buy the stock just before the ex-dividend date, you will be responsible for paying the taxes, and presumably the stock price will fall commensurate with the amount of the dividend, which doesn't usually happen. So you are better off waiting until after the ex-dividend date so that you will get the stock at a better price and not have to pay the taxes on the dividend. You know, if you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of shares, yeah, I can see it would make sense. But for those of us buying 10 shares, it doesn't matter, you know. But that's what you're going to hear it. Maybe you deal with some old veterans. At the brokerage firm I worked at when I first started, the woman who ran it retired, and I went over to, she sold to another company. We had a client who, that's what he would do. He would right before the stock went dividend, ex-dividend, he would buy the shares, and he bought a lot, just to get the dividend and then turn around and sell it afterwards, after the date of record, so that he could get the dividends. It worked for him. I thought it was kind of ridiculous, because what happens if the stock, you know, just takes a bump in 2 days? To me, it just seems like you're renting the stock. You're not buying the stock. Obviously, that's what he's doing. He's renting it just for the dividend. But it worked for him, and that was his strategy. And so, yeah, that's it. But what you're going to hear is, don't buy the dividend. Oh, but just realize, for the vast majority of us, it really doesn't matter that much. So when you want to buy the stock, buy it. When you want to sell the stock, sell it. And the dividends shouldn't be the tail that wags the dog. Slide 72. Now, everything in this is very important. Yes, all this stuff is from study hard, dear students. Slide 72, we talk about the different types of dividends. And there are basically two different types. Cash dividends, where you get the dividend in cash. That's what you want. You want a cash dividend. The second type are called stock dividends. And what do they do? They pay you in the form of additional shares of stock. Does that sound familiar? It's kind of like a stock split. All else equal, stock dividends have no value because they constitute a dilution of ownership. If the board of directors declares a 10% stock dividend, for every 10 shares, you're going to receive an extra share. But what's going to happen to the price of the stock? It's going to drop by 10%. So did you actually get anything? No. It's just another accounting maneuver. But unlike a cash dividend, a stock dividend is not taxed. Well, thank you very much, IRS, for taxing me for something that's not worth anything, for not taxing me about for something that's not worth anything. So no taxes, big deal, is not worth anything anyway. It shouldn't be taxed. So do you understand the difference? Good, because we're going to throw a little wrinkle in here now. Remember, you want cash dividends. You don't want stock dividends. Slide 73. The third way that we can get our dividends is from reinvested shares. And there, I love the name, Dividend Reinvestment Plan, a DRIP. Would you want a DRIP? Yeah, as a matter of fact, they're cool, especially with older companies that pay, you know, generous dividends, have their roots in the economy. Because what does a dividend plan do? They take those cash dividends and they automatically reinvest it in additional shares of the firm's common stock. You see what they did? They paid you $100, but they didn't give you the cash. They went out and bought shares of that stock. They didn't issue new shares. They bought those shares. So it's a taxable transaction because it's a cash dividend, and there are no additional shares were issued. So there's no dilution of ownership. And most larger companies have the ability to go to the company directly and say, you know what? I'd like to buy your shares through a dividend reinvestment plan. Do you offer one? And they say, yeah. You look on their website, look for investor relationships or investor communications, and they don't do it. Somebody else does it for them. There's companies that do this for you. And there's one company that will allow, I think it's actually more than one company, that will allow you to have your DRIPs all in one place. All brokerage firms also allow you to have dividend reinvestment plans too. But you have to pay the brokerage commission for when you buy the shares. This, no. No, 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 no. You go directly to a company like Coca-Cola and you say, or we did Sempra Energy, which is SDG&E, when I was in an investment club. And we bought the shares directly from them. Now, some company does it for SDG&E, but we paid no commissions and we paid very little fees. You know, every once in a while they hit us with a 3-cent or 9-cent fee. So it's a very cool way for long-term investors to take advantage of compounding automatically with normally no or incredibly small transaction costs. And there's an example that's out on the class website. I put it in Canvas. Here in the face-to-face class is where we would look at the dividend reinvestment plan that the partnership investment club I was in had. Cool? So make sure you check that out, because we're almost ready for a break here. Slide number 74, price to earnings ratio. Bum, bum, bum. Okay, fine. The PE is one of the most, if not the most, widely sought after and followed stock market statistic. And it's a very simple calculation. You take the price and you divide it by the earnings. So sometimes you'll see it as P divided by E or just PE. Usually you see PE. It's, you take, say, the company we were looking at before, $20 stock price. If their earnings per share are $2, you take 20 divided by 2, and you wind up with T at 10. $20 divided by $2, 10. Now, the dollar signs cancel out. So don't put a dollar sign. Don't put a percent sign. PE is unitless. And traditionally, stocks sold for anywhere from 5 to 14, and a PE of 20 was only reserved for the fastest growing stocks. Well, sometimes in the 1920s and then the 1960s and then 1980s and 90s, PEs were far greater than 20, and they were just way high. And we're going to come back to PE in detail because it's a very important statistic. We've already made a little mention to it. But in general, just realize the higher the PE, the more riskier the investment, and the more potential investors believe for growth. In the 2008 turmoil, PEs came down very lot. Why? Because the price fell. Think about it, folks. If you put price divided by earnings, if the price falls, the PE is going to fall. If the earnings fall, the PE is going to rise. It's the denominator. So it's a very simple statistic, but there's a whole lot behind it and a whole lot of baggage that it follows around that we'll discuss in more detail. So you got it? Go back over, study these common stock characteristics, dividends, earnings per share, PE, and make sure you do worksheet number 2, which has a few, I think three problems that have to do with earnings per share, dividend payout ratio, and price to earnings ratio. Cool? Because in our next presentation, we're going to do our best to wrap our arms around the different types of stock, realizing that there's more than just the types that we're going to look at. But these are the major categories. Just as we did with mutual funds, we're going to do with stocks. Because there's no greater myth than to say that all stocks are the same. That's just not true. No. So study this, and we'll see you in our next presentation when we take a look at the different types of stocks. Be awesome, students. We are so proud of you.